Find Learn From People Who Lived It wherever you get podcasts. Search it using all one word, Learn From People Who Lived It.
Welcome to another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It.
Hi there, it's Matthew Blades, and we are about to spend 50 minutes with a woman named Marianne, and of course our good friend Dr. Dave from our Reserved for Vets podcast. The subject today is sudden loss, suicide, addiction. And we're going to meet Marianne, who has started Eric's House because her son completed suicide. Did you know that for every loss, 135 people are impacted by that loss? Think of the generations to come that have to deal with the repercussions of somebody taking their own life. You can imagine how complicated this space is, which is why it's wonderful that there are people like Marianne and Eric's House out there that are helping out with postvention. Yes, you've probably heard of prevention, but this organization is focused on postvention for those living in the aftermath of those devastating losses. So here we go, a conversation with Marianne, who founded Eric's House, here on Learn From People Who Lived It. I want to welcome you to Learn From People Who Lived It today. We're on location with Dr. Dave and a woman named Marianne, who started this incredible place called Eric's House. We're going to learn about Eric. We're going to learn about what happens inside these walls. We're going to talk about mind, body, spirit. We're going to talk about fundraising, peer support. We're going to talk about suicide, addiction, grief, and most importantly, how you can help. So I want to welcome you to our podcast today. First up, Dr. Dave, thank you for being alongside us today.
A pleasure as always.
And Marianne, thank you for inviting us.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I am so interested in what's happening here at Eric's House. But before I get too far, I think it's important we find out who this Eric guy was and why we even have this place. So that's where I'm going to ask you to start. If you don't mind, tell us a little bit about Eric.
Okay. Well, thanks for asking about Eric, because that's a really important part of healing. Eric was my my youngest son. And, you know, it's a story that we hear often. In high school, he had an injury. And as a result of that injury, he had many, many surgeries. And he was left with a disabled right hand. And so he was prescribed OxyContin. And I learned after he died that he had prescriptions for over 500 OxyContin pills per month. And they were getting filled by a doctor who was running a pill mill on the west side of Phoenix. But he certainly became addicted to OxyContin. He transitioned to heroin, because OxyContin can buy a lot of heroin. And so he struggled with addiction. He came to me one day and said, I need help because I'm a heroin addict. And so he went to rehab for a while, and he came out. He was clean for a year, and he had a relapse. He had a relapse during the Christmas holidays, and 6 months later, he chose to end his life. And so he died by suicide. I had just spoken with him the night before, and we were going to go to breakfast. He wasn't answering his cell phone or texts, and so I went over, and of course I found him. And, you know, as you can imagine, many of us who find our children in that state, we experience a lot of trauma. And there was really very little help for me. You know, they wheel you off, they put you in a fire truck, they have counselors there to help you. And there was a card in there of a woman here locally. She specialized in grief for suicide. And I was lucky to get in to see her. And that began my healing journey. But for Eric was really a fun, loving, open, generous young man who was a pleasure to be around. So thank you for asking.
Well, it's an important ingredient. We hear it all the time. Sadly, you are going to be, you know, maybe the third or the fourth person that I've talked to, mom, who's lost a child to either drugs or, you know, death by suicide. Right. And so clearly we have kind of a pandemic. I know from your experience, Dr. Dave, in the veteran community, this stuff runs rampant. My brother has had three friends who have ended their lives by suicide after coming back from war. So I know you see this all the time. Give me your thoughts on it.
Yeah, certainly over the years, I've talked to a lot of people that have dealt with suicidal thoughts. You know, as a psychiatrist, occasionally you experience losing a patient yourself. You know, despite your best efforts, people manage to find a way of ending their life. So it's very hard, and I empathize with the story. I've heard similar losses from other people, and it's very hard to find your way back out of it again.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about just the lead up to it? Because I think that's an important ingredient to this thing. And our podcast is called Learn From People Who Lived It For a Reason. I think that your testimony may tee up another mom or a dad mm-hmm. to recognize something, to learn something, and come away after this podcast with like a nugget or something that they feel is valuable. So you mentioned to me that he had gotten his OxyContin, he had found a way into heroin. He had mentioned to you that he needed help. That couldn't have been an easy conversation for him to come to his mother and say, "Mom, I'm hooked on drugs and I think I need help." How was that moment for you guys? How was that moment for your family?
Well, of course, I was in shock. I mean, first of all, you never think that's going to happen to your family and that your child's going to do that. You couldn't tell Eric was an addict. He just acted normal all the time, so it wasn't real clear. I knew he was struggling. The most difficult thing for our family was I was his caregiver. Once I realized he was struggling with something, I was his caregiver. And I really worked hard on trying to keep him alive. So when he died, you know, I just had this big sense of failure. Like, what did I do wrong? But I realized that I did everything I could do to keep Eric alive. And then in that one moment when Eric made that decision, that fatal decision, I couldn't protect him. It was just that one moment. And when we work with people who have had similar loss experiences, we see that same thing. For a long period of time, they just struggle with trying to get an answer to what they did wrong and why couldn't they have prevented that? And as a father, as a mother, or even if you lose a spouse, how come you didn't see this coming? And really, that gave me the energy to realize that I really walked every inch of every mile with him out of just pure love. And he didn't want this for himself, and I did certainly not want it for him. But I realized we did everything that we could do. It was just that one split second when he made that decision to do that.
What's going on, Dr. Dave, in somebody's mind when they make that decision that they're going to do something to harm themselves?
Yeah. A lot of times there's a lead up to it. And from my experience talking with people, suicide is a very ambivalent sort of thing. It runs through people's minds. They kind of contemplate it. And it comes and goes based on whatever they're dealing with. So for people that are dealing with chronic pain is a big risk factor for suicide, especially if it's something that's not going to ever go away. So there was a period of time, you know, with opiates right now, the broad medical opinion is to avoid using them, mm-hmm. right? The problem is they work. They alleviate pain. There's some studies out now that show that maybe the opiates are sensitizing you to pain. So as they're treating the pain, they're also making you more sensitive to pain. Mm-hmm. And then you start needing more and more medications. You know, so if somebody becomes hooked on that many oxycodone, you become stuck. So if you stop taking them, the pain comes back, you go into withdrawals. You know, that's something a lot of times people don't realize that that's what's happening.
Can I ask you a question? Yeah. You've mentioned in the past before that when people are addicted to alcohol, it turns off the part of the brain that cares. Does the same thing happen with opioids?
No, I don't think so.
No?
Yeah.
Okay.
But the problem is the withdrawal effects of opioids are pretty much immediate. So if you miss your cycle, you know, if you've gotten so used to taking a certain amount of medication per day and you miss your cycle, you'll start feeling it right away. You'll feel sick, get shaky, sweaty, nauseous, throwing up, a lot of, you know, stomach symptoms.
But you said, Marianne, that he did a pretty good job of maybe disguising some of these
things
for you. He was very functional in his pain. And so you didn't get to see it. You didn't get let in except when he would say, hey, Mom, I need help, which didn't happen enough.
Right.
Probably.
Which is why it was such a shock.
Yeah.
Because it was as though he was functioning normally. And I think he was actually functioning normally. I think when he didn't have enough opioid in his system is when he would start acting weird, you know, abnormal. But as long as he had it in his system, he was just acting like Eric.
I wonder when Eric was getting closer to the actual pivotal day, did he show you anything at all?
No. We had just talked the night before, and we were going to go for pancakes the next morning. So it's a mystery, really. It's a mystery. And so you learn to live with unanswered questions. They remain in your heart. You don't know why. But there was no sign.
It's not natural to lose our children before we die. So what did that do to you?
It made me feel the pain of that to the deepest depths that you could, because it really affects you emotionally, physically, spiritually. And everything I believed to be true about life was shattered. It's almost like a broken vase, right? And you have to put that vase back together again in a way that is healthy, but takes a long time to get through that. The pain, especially if you find your child, but even if you don't, you still imagine what happened in those last few moments. The pain is so deep and so shattering that you stay numb for a very long period of time, 4 months, 5 months, you're numb, and you think you're getting better, the numbness wears off, and it's like you're going right back. And then the reality begins to set in. And I always tell people, you know, you have to approach your new reality very slowly because it takes time to heal from this. And it's hard to imagine you can live with this. And then you have the issues of dealing with your family. And then you have a lot of social issues, as you probably are aware.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to go next,
yeah,
the people around
you.
A lot
of social issues that arise. We call them secondary losses or ripple effect losses.
You call them compound fractures. Yeah. Right, same kind of thing. Was that a difficult space to navigate after because you were the mom whose son completed suicide?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's difficult.
Still.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've made choices about who I interact with. I've had to make choices because you have to decide somewhere throughout that first year, 18 months, that you are going to be healthy. I mean, I remember lying on the floor in my closet, curled up in a ball, keening, and there wasn't anything anybody could do to bring me out of that funk. Once I made up my mind that, you know, this is really a horrible experience for anyone to go through, I decided to, you know, put my experience into action and do something good for other people. And that led us to Eric's house.
Yeah, because I would imagine for you, it's important that this means something, right? Like Eric's life has to take on a different kind of meaning for you now.
Yeah. Well, completely.
Yeah.
I thank God for Eric, actually, every day, because look at what we're doing. We're really helping a lot of people.
Yeah.
We've had over 2,000 sessions with clients since we started.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's good.
So you get an idea of how we got here. And then now I think it's really important to talk about what happens when people get into this space. And I know you guys have a huge fundraiser coming up, and the kind of work that's happening in here is important. Dave, what do you want to get out real quick?
Yeah. Before we transition to
Please.
A different topic, you know, one of the things that's particularly difficult after a loss like that is you have family members and friends that are well-meaning, and sometimes they end up being Job's counselors. Mm-hmm. You mean you didn't see it coming? Like, how did you not see that? Right, so then questions that you're already asking yourself and trying to struggle through and work through, then instead of somebody being comforting, they end up kind of compounding the pain that you're going through. So I understand kind of limiting who you're interacting with and under what circumstances, and truly finding that one or two, maybe three people that you really connect with, and they can just kind of share a space with you and not even say anything, but just be a support with their presence. And, you know, you need to find that as part of the healing path.
I'm glad that you said that, because it, you know, I asked Carrie the same question. It's like, what can people say to you? You know, what are things that are on the table? And I'll tell you the number one thing, and the reason that I asked about Eric the moment we started recording was because of that. She said that to me. She said the number one thing people do is they act like he never was alive.
Right.
They don't say his name around me anymore. They don't ask me about him anymore. Nobody wants to, it's like the, you know, the taboo subject or something like that.
They're afraid to, I think.
Yeah, but the greatest thing I can do is ask you about Eric.
Right. That's right.
And give you an opportunity to talk about
him.
Exactly. Yes.
You know, there's a lot of stigma. And what we see in our work is people are afraid of it. Sometimes it might be too close to home, where they may have had similar situations with suicide or drug abuse and in their families. But most of the time, people are just afraid to hurt you. Like, they don't want to see you cry. And they're afraid if they bring it up, well, you're going to start crying, or, you know, and they don't want to be responsible for that. We use a guide, which we call the rule of thirds, and we say, you know, there's going to be some people, that first third group are going to be the people that really hold space for you, that are there for you no matter what. They're not judging, and they're not fixing. And then that middle third are the people who are neutral. They don't do anything to help, but they don't hurt you either. And then that third group are the people that are trying to fix you. They want you to move on. They want you to get over it. Come on, it's been 6 months, you know. And those people are not helpful. And so during that period of healing, we really encourage people to think about who they want to share with and who they want to spend time with, because that then empowers and supports their healing process.
Dave, do you think people need to change their environment after an event like this?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes. I've certainly talked to people that if they were living in the house with somebody who passed away, that they have to move. Too many reminders, too many little things. And it just keeps bringing back memories in a ruminative and reliving sort of way that doesn't aid in healing, but just kind of keeps people stuck in the trauma.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so when you come to Eric's house, let's dive in a little bit about it, because we just got a tour. We saw a few of the rooms that we walked into, and so I have a better understanding of what's happening here. You use a lot of peer support to help people through their grief. And we had a doctor on our show, a different doctor on our show, and he said most people don't need a doctor. They need somebody to listen to them. Mm-hmm. And so it seems a little bit like that's what's happening here. And you told me several times now that you are about mind, body, and spirit. Mm-hmm. It's a holistic approach to helping people heal. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, our primary activity is group support and one-on-one peer support. And so that helps people process through emotionally, or even just have a space to cry, where it's kind of sacred space and it's safe. And then our groups are we do a lot of talk in our groups, and we do some grief education. So, like, you know, I listened to a song in my car and I broke down crying, or I lost my keys. So we give people a vocabulary
That's good.
That they can use to apply to whatever it is they're feeling. And the other thing is we create community for them so they can share and interact with one another outside of group. And so it becomes a community of support. But I know that many of us struggle physically. I know for me, I stopped eating altogether. You could not get me to eat. And so just even eating would just make me feel terrible. And I couldn't breathe. And so we began to look at why you can't breathe. Most of us slump over and we're just not getting good breath. So we decided to do integrative grief care, mind, body, spirit support. So we have things around breath work. We offer breath work classes. We do Reiki, which, believe it or not, we can do distant Reiki, and it's really wonderful. It gives people just a pause, you know, a 60 or 90 minute pause from this crazy chaos that goes on in your brain. A lot of people have a crisis of faith. We support all faiths or no faiths, but a lot of people really get angry with whoever their God is. And so we have non-denominational spiritual directors that just help them sort through that. We do workshops and retreats. We're starting nutrition. Nutrition through grief. We teach people how to eat. We have a nutritionist coming on board for our fundraiser on October 8th. She's going to talk about what you should be eating and supplements you should be taking while you're in that deep state of grief. So, and we also do journaling and, you know, just whatever we assess our client base needs.
Dr. Dave's quick to say that when we experience trauma, it goes on our permanent record. Therefore, it's never going away. Therefore, nobody could ever fix it.
Right.
This is a permanent problem.
Right.
Right. Eric is gone. You don't get to fix that part. Maybe jump on that a little bit in terms of how people can then deal with that thought.
Yeah, I don't think there's one way to grieve, and I don't think that there's a specific timetable for grieving. Everybody kind of takes it at their own pace. I think being able to talk and talk through things with people is a really important part of it. And sometimes it's talking about the little things, you know, the anniversaries that are coming up and, he's not here. Okay. And then you have to kind of process that in real time as it happens. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, finding an old picture and then that kind of mm-hmm. stirs something up and you have to process through that. Mm-hmm. But having other people around to be able to talk that through, you hear the words coming out of your own mouth. It kind of gives shape to the story right. and the narrative of what's going to happen going forward.
Right.
Plus the journaling that you're doing. I mean, it's just, yeah. you're helping people get it out, which is
right.
great.
Right. Yeah. Right. And we have great results from journaling. One thing that we do offer every year is we offer a support group for holiday grief.
That's the hard one.
That's a big one.
And we help people sort through what they might want to do, which is especially difficult for newly bereaved. We help them sort through and create a plan. We have them do a plan A, plan B, plan C. So they have lots of different choices and are free to do whatever they need to do when it comes to the holidays. And that's usually one of our most popular groups. Everybody wants to do that group.
I have heard in the past that when you lose a family member like this, it's difficult to push through the holidays for the first mm-hmm. few years. I want to ask you a couple of questions that may be hard, but were the holidays tough? How was his birthday? And then were you able to take family pictures? And if so, how long did it take you to get together to do that after the fact?
Great question. So yes, the first couple of holidays are really difficult. They're really difficult. I remember the first Christmas we went through without Eric. He died in February, so it was several months. I set a plate for him at the table, and that was just great. It was just great. It wasn't, you know, it was just acknowledging that he was part of the family, but that he wasn't there. He's with us in spirit, right? The next year, we just watched a little video of Eric and went on with our family plans. But now it's okay. It's okay. We don't do anything special. Eric is such a huge part of our life. In fact, we talk about often in group that our kids are ever so much more present in our lives in their death than when they were alive. When they're alive, they just drive away or go out of town or whatever. But when they're in spirit, they're around us all the time. I think about Eric all the time, and I have great, happy memories. And we try to help people get to that point where, you know, they're not just stuck in that bubble of my child died, or my husband died, my wife died. We can help them move past that. And, of course, it does take time. But the nice thing about our work and the thing I love about our work is we actually laugh. We actually laugh and have fun and, you know, share stories with each other. And I think that's what makes us special, because I think laughter has a lot to do with healing.
It sure does.
Yeah. It's a huge piece of the puzzle. I mean, there are so many different things that are going to help us get to where we need to go. And I remember when my dad died, and you sit in that space where you think, my God, I am literally never going to smile again. Like, the pain is so intense that, you know, you start having your own thoughts of like, I don't even know how I can go about this. But what's encouraging is there will be a day where when you hear his name, it makes you smile instead of cry.
Mm-hmm.
How long did it take for you to get there? Sorry, I get emotional in these conversations, but how long did it take you to get there?
Probably 3 years.
Yeah.
Probably 3 years. Yeah.
What does that look like now? What is your relationship like now?
It's great.
Yeah. Do you talk to him in the car?
No. My time in the car is private.
Yeah. All right, good.
But I do talk to him all the time. Yeah. You know, I have his picture a couple places throughout the house along with the other kids, and I remember things that he said. He's a big inspiration to me. He was actually a pretty wise kid. He died when he was 27. And he's around me. I can just feel him.
What about the rest of the people in your family? How have you been through helping them in this?
Well, that's another great question, because Eric's older brother is Down syndrome. He's 35. And Joey, his name is Joey. Joey's very connected. Very connected spiritually. And it's kind of funny, because Joey is always talking to Eric. Joey goes out, he looks at the stars, and he says, you know, I see Eric tonight, or I didn't see Eric. But when I ask him, did Eric say anything to you? He says, yes, he told me to tell you, you need to buy me a new iPad.
Yes, I like it. He's working the system. He's working the system.
My older son really struggled for a while because it's tough when you have a sibling that is struggling with addiction. And he struggled for a long time. And he did go through some counseling. But he's doing great now. He's, you know, got a very successful law practice and is doing some great things with a podcast. And so he's great. My husband of 25 years, I think, he'll probably say I'm wrong, but he's Eric's stepdad. And he really struggled as a stepfather. That's a whole nother dimension to this. But he's doing great. You know, the whole family is really doing well. We weathered the storm and are, you know, doing a lot to help other people. This is our full-time commitment.
We've talked about this a lot, that when somebody dies, oftentimes it's like the blind leading the blind. Everybody in the family's hurt. Everybody's in pain. Nobody can really help anybody out. So give me some tools, Dr. Dave, in that space.
Yeah. Well, you know, listening to your story, it reminds me, because I've dealt with a lot of folks that have gone through traumas, and the highest phase of processing trauma is getting it through narrative memory. So, you know, at first when you lose somebody, you're re-experiencing it, you have intrusive thoughts, you have intrusive memories of things that have happened. That fades over time for a lot of people. And then it's the anniversaries and the recollections, and, you know, that keeps it alive episodically for a while. But it's trying to find meaning in the situation and find a purpose that comes out of that. That's where you process trauma at the highest level. And I think that's what people need to strive for is, you know, at first it's not clear what happened, and you know, there's always going to be those unanswered questions and things that you just have to accept that I'll never know why this went the way that it did. But yet out of that, trying to find some meaning and purpose and a reason to go forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of it, when you can incorporate reaching out to other people in whatever form that looks like, you know, when you focus on others and get outside of yourself, I think that provides you probably the best ground for long-term healing.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think what we've done with Eric's house has been really instrumental in our whole family's healing. And we feel good about it. We feel good about it.
Well, we talked about that in the room, right? Like, this becomes the medicine.
Yeah.
Taking care of other people that have gone through it. And listen, one of the reasons that we're here today is to encourage you, if you're listening to our podcast right now and some of what we're talking about is speaking to you, there are opportunities within Eric's house for you, especially people that have gone through this before and know where and how to put these things, because that's suicide is a confusing space, like you said. There still is a little bit of there's a lot of a stigma around it, right? Have you ever had to punch somebody for just saying the wrong thing?
Gosh, well, you're so full of great questions. I haven't had to punch anybody.
Yeah, metaphorically speaking, yeah, right?
But I had a really close friend that just she was also close to Eric. She's totally disappeared. And it's those kinds of things where you realize, gosh, life really will never be the same. So you get these little anger bursts that really don't last very long, but it's like, gosh, why did that happen? Yeah. Right. So there really are a lot of mysteries in this loss experience. But for the most part, yeah, you know, I haven't really felt like I needed to punch anybody or kick them.
Yeah, right, right. Well, you know, there were times I remember after my dad was like, you have to leave. You can't be in my space right now. Like, it's zero of what you're saying is helping. Because again, getting it back to people like to fix things, and we're never going to be able to fix this thing. Right. Dave, we talked about the peer support that she's got in there. And I know there's psychologists, there's psychiatrists, and then there's just us regular everyday folks who've been through a couple of tough things in life and have some space to hold for folks. So where is the line for psychiatry? Where's the line for psychology? Where's the line for peer support?
Yeah, so I think everybody who's going through a tough time, a loss, needs people around them that they can just get together with and be able to share space with and vent to. That's not necessarily a clinical thing, right? That's just a support thing. And that person can be there more frequently than a therapist can be there or a psychiatrist could be there. So that's a really useful function to have. And for the person who is providing that, the friend that's there to reach out to somebody who's hurting, you know, you're serving a really important role. And it's a blessing to be able to be in that space to be able to help somebody. There are some things that people struggle with that really impacts their daily life and their ability to move forward. So like sleep problems, eating problems, depression to where you're becoming withdrawn, pulling away from people, maybe brushing off people that are trying to be supportive and helpful. You know, and when those things start to come in, and especially when they're clearly interfering with things, it's time to get professional help.
Mm-hmm. You've said before a number of times on our podcast that that's what makes it a disorder, is when it starts to impact your life and the people around you.
Yeah.
And so peer support, if I'm understanding you correctly, is helpful when people just need to get some things off their chest. They need to talk about some things. But if something is escalated to the point where maybe they're hurting people around them, they're getting really nasty around people, then you're suggesting it's time for level two. It's time to step it up a little bit.
I mean, people are going to cry.
Of course they are.
There's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. People are going to have sleepless nights. There's nothing wrong with that, right? You're going to lose your appetite from time to time. You're going to have a day where you're in the hole and you don't want to see anybody, deal with anybody. You know, that's all a normal part of the grieving process. So I kind of think of it like a rubber band. You know, you're pulling in one direction, you know, and some of the things are causing trouble, but there should be a natural pull that brings you back to the midline again, right? So if you've holed away for a day, right? I don't want to deal with anybody. I don't want to see anybody. Okay, now it's day two. I just can't deal with anybody right now. There should be a little something inside of you that says, no, I have to get up. I have to take a shower. I have to go out and get groceries. I have to do something functional, right? If that fails to kick in, right, after day three, after day four, right, at some point, like something has to click that, okay, this is a problem, right? But the ebb and flow is normal. And I don't think you want to over-pathologize that and say, well, you know, you got to, you know, run to see a therapist immediately. I mean, you know, it'll work itself out over time. And there's no one way to do this.
That's kind of the hardest part about it, right? Yeah. Is that time's the only thing that fixes it.
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
Yeah.
Well, you have to go through it. It's a process. I mean, and I don't think anybody really wants to, but, you know, we've talked about this before with some of the PTSD broadcasts that we've done, is that if you're experiencing a pain and you did nothing to bring it on, it's just, you know, life took you down a path that led to pain. You've already paid the tuition. Now try to get something out of that experience. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's kind of my practical way of looking at it, that, you know, you're here and you're not going to escape it. You can't undo it. You just have to figure out the best way to move forward and
start Eric's house.
Yeah.
Start Eric's house. That's how you do it.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. And then, so you have 2,000, did you say, in the last couple of years, people rolling through here?
We have had 2,600 sessions with clients, you know, comprised of one-on-one and group sessions. About 500 clients. We'll have 60 to 70 people in group every week, except for we take a month or two off between groups. We have a really successful men's group that does really well.
Can I ask what happens in the men's group?
Well, I never attend them, so I don't know for sure, but they're mostly open. They're mostly open. It's really a collaborative exchange of men from various backgrounds who have various losses, most of them sudden losses, most of them overdoses and suicides. And they have a question each week, and they reflect and contemplate that question. And they just share with each other. We think our groups are successful when the group takes on its own healing energy, right? When they're talking to each other.
How important is that, Dave, to have a group of men talking? Because this is, I've always said this, this is what women do incredibly well. They get together and they talk about what's going on. They talk about what they're feeling. Men to get together and they watch sports. They do everything in their power to disconnect from it. Like, they don't want to hit it head on. But that's what we have to do, is hit it head on. So
I didn't hear that you have a women's group, right?
We have several women's groups.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's implied, right? The women are all getting together. They've got this figured out. Right. It's the guys who are slow to the party. Yeah.
So I think you need to have the men's group specifically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, guys by nature, I think, are fixers. And that means I have to fix this myself. And so sit down, try to figure it out. Okay, it's not working. I got to try harder, do something different, right? So the benefit of having a men's group, and especially if you're meeting with other people that are in similar circumstances, if you allow yourself, you'll find that the way other people maybe have handled their situation, there's some gems there for you. Mm-hmm. There's some things that you can try. I think one of the biggest things that's helpful for people is just realizing you're not the only one that's going through it. You know, having a major loss sometimes feels like you're the only person in the world that's going through this, and it's very lonely and isolating. So getting out around other people a lot of times can kind of make that connection that, okay, I'm not the only one. And what I'm dealing with that seems so abnormal from my day-to-day before, this is actually pretty normal. A lot of people are having trouble sleeping, maybe losing their appetite, having depression.
Sounds like that was helpful for you to find other people.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and normalizing the experience is the first step in being able to talk about it and then understand it and then process it. And when you're at that stage in your recovery, that's a choice that you can make, right? So at first, all the bad stuff is there. But I think if you allow yourself, you can choose what you think about when you think about that person.
So I'm going to ask you, what do you think about when you think about Eric?
Eric had a big belly laugh.
Okay.
And he loved his brother Joey. He just loved Joey. And they would play around, and he would sit and listen. And, you know, he took such amazing care of Joey. And that's how I remember him. He was really big-hearted and a real genuine person. And we have another Down syndrome person in our family as well. And he would just spend time with them and just hang out with them, just help them. And that's what I remember about Eric.
Is there anything our community can do to help Eric's house? Is there, I mean, you must be looking for areas of growth and assistance. And what would people need to know?
Well, we're always looking for volunteers.
Don't hold back here.
We're always looking for volunteers who are maybe 3 years out from their loss, maybe 3 or 4 years out from their loss, and are in a position where they want to give back. We send them to training. We do quite a bit of training for those people, and then we can have them start a new group for us. So that's really important. We always need donations. That's the big thing. We charge almost nothing for our services, and about 70% of our people are on scholarship. So we rely on donations. We have a fundraiser coming up on October 8th, World Mental Health Day, and it'll be virtual. And we'll have a program that promotes health and wellness during this grief experience. And so, you know, people, if they want to visit our website, they can take a look at our agenda and, you know, gain knowledge and information and even healing from the events of that day.
Erickshouse.org, while she says that, go ahead.
Yeah. And if you know somebody that, there's a suicide every 11 minutes in this country. And for every suicide, there's 25 attempts. There's many that go unreported that are not suicides. I gave a talk one day with about 700 people there. And I said, look to your right, look to your left. Chances are one of you have been impacted by suicide or substance abuse. And so we all know somebody. Raising awareness is very, very important, allowing yourself to talk to people about it. But referring to us is also good. We'll make ourselves available at any time for somebody that has lost somebody and needs support.
Dave, I want to lean on you a little bit here as we kind of wind down this podcast to say maybe we speak to some of the folks who are considering suicide. You know, maybe they're in a space where their world has gotten so hard that they believe that this is the solution for them. Just being gone, that would fix all the problems. We've said it 1,000 times. Suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. What's your advice to people that are having really hard days?
You have to reach out to somebody. Sometimes it's hard to know what the solution is. It's hard to know what the next step is. If you're dealing with chronic physical pain, it's hard to see a future without that, and that leads to hopelessness. But I think you have to reach out to people that are close to you, especially before it gets to the point where you're seriously considering it. If you draw your support in early and get people around you early, then that increases your options. That increases the ability to find another way to go forward. But even if you're kind of at that last point, reach out to somebody close to you. I don't think you realize what the ripple is going to be through generations, not just through the immediate family and through the immediate people that you touch, but even the next generation afterwards, how that affects them. Part of being in that space of depression and considering suicide, a lot of times people undervalue themselves. They don't realize how much people actually care about them. I can tell you from speaking to a number of suicide survivors, how shocked and surprised they were, the outpouring of support that they had after surviving their suicide attempt. And when I sat down and talked with them, they said, I would never do this again. I had no idea how much people cared about me and how much people loved me until I did this. And not saying that you should do it to get that support. The support is there. But it was kind of eye-opening to them in a way that they would never consider trying to end their life again, regardless of what happened.
That's a great answer. Mm-hmm. I think one of my final questions for you, Marianne, is what did Eric teach you?
Well, Eric taught me love, for sure, because I just feel like I just love him so much more now, right? I don't know how to explain it. And he also taught me gratitude, but living in the present moment is probably the biggest thing, because we never know what life holds for us. And so, you know, I come from the aerospace world, right? You never lived in the present moment. You either lived in the past or the future, but never in the present.
That's a good point.
And, you know, I've learned that what's in front of me right now is what is the most important thing in that particular moment. And so I try to focus on that. I don't stress very much about anything anymore. And I have a renewed relationship with my son, Joey, because Joey and Eric were just so close, so incredibly close. And so I really treasure that and do everything I can do to spend as much time with him as I can. Yeah. Eric was a very generous person, and he was a helper. And I learned that with him up there and me down here, we're not really all that separated, because he lives on through me in my memory and certainly in a relationship of spirit. And so that was a whole new world for me, coming from a really buttoned up, tightened up career, to think that your child is really around you all the time. And you can choose to have that in your life and reflect it in ways that, you know, give other people hope as well.
So I bet when you were in your 20s and going to college and coming up and getting your first job and doing all the things that all the people do, and you thought about legacy and purpose and meaning and all the things that you would accomplish in your life, you never saw this one coming within a 100 miles.
Never.
But your life has taken on a renewed purpose.
Absolutely.
And a renewed meaning. It's impossible to answer this question because he's not here to answer it, but how do you feel as though Eric would feel about the legacy that you're trying to leave with this?
You know, honestly, Eric had very little ego, so I think he would be proud. I think he would be proud of his family. I think he would be proud of the Eric's House team, because they all do such great work. And I think he probably is laughing. He's kind of laughing at some of the things we do and some of the mistakes we make and how we learn from each other as we you know, embark on this journey of healing. And so I think he would be proud.
Yeah, it's always so neat for me to sit down with moms and dads who have been through this, because I feel like I get to meet your kids through you,
yeah,
which is neat for me.
Well, you know, the other thing that's neat for me is that people are always thanking Eric. Like, I'll get an email, well, gosh, I'm so sorry for your loss, but I'm so grateful for Eric. And so at the end of group, we get these little salutes to Eric. And, you know, that's really nice. That makes me feel good.
Final thoughts from you, Dave, as we wrap up.
Yeah, I think some of the best things that happen in terms of people's accomplishments come out of very dark places. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look into the histories of Olympic athletes and people that are driven to succeed, doing things that most regular people would have given up decades ago, if you look deep inside, a lot of times there's a torment. There's some type of something that they're processing that drives them, a sense of purpose.
Yeah. You have on the back of your brochure something kind of beautiful. You've got a picture of a dandelion. Mm-hmm. And it says, the dandelion thrives in difficult conditions. It's no wonder that people say the flower symbolizes the ability to rise above life's challenges. When you become a member of Eric's House, you will receive hope and healing with the tools and resources to help you rise above the pain and sorrow. And that thing I said earlier is certainly true, that one day you'll hear their name and it'll make you smile mm-hmm. versus cry. Mm-hmm. I just love what you're doing here.
Thank you.
And I'm honored that you shared Eric with us in this way. I get choked up in these things, as Dave knows, at the end of it, because I have kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And this is an impossible thing to cycle through.
It is.
But there are so many good people who really just want to help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this place is one of them.
Yeah.
So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Dave, appreciate you being a part of this.
Last thoughts from you as we wrap up. Anything that we've left on the table today that we shouldn't have?
Just one comment about the dandelion.
Please.
It's our icon. And every time I would look at a dandelion, I would think, oh, you know, I'm here right at this moment to adore that dandelion. I was in Jackson Hole recently, and there were huge dandelions everywhere. And that just brought me back home that really our kids are all around us all the time.
All the time.
And that's really the thing that gives us hope. So we love the dandelion.
We love the dandelion. Erikshouse.org. Look him up. Maybe there's an opportunity for you here to help somebody else out. Maybe you've been through this yourself. And I'm telling you the truth. This will be your medicine. Helping other people cycle through their pain will 100% be your medicine to get through this. Thank you very much for your time. Dave, be well. We'll see everybody next time on Learn From People Who Lived It.
We have three goals with Learn From People Who Lived It. One, to help you feel less alone. Two, encourage you to seek out a coach, a therapist, a church, anyone who can help you get through your journey and find some healing. Three, when you're ready, share your story with us.
Find Learn From People Who Lived It wherever you get podcast. Search it using all one word, Learn From People Who Lived It.